Accession number 10657, reel number 4.
Major Lewis, reel 4. You were telling me you'd found some exact dates for your service.
Yes, I think I can run through from the time I was commissioned, from the time I joined the Artists' Rifles, actually. I joined the Artists' Rifles on the 5th of October 1937 at the age of 19. I was discharged on the 16th of June 1939 and commissioned in the Queen's Royal Regiment on the 17th of June. The battalion was embodied on the 1st of September 1939. We went over to France as part of the BEF on the 22nd of February 1940, and we returned from France via Cherbourg on the 7th of June 1940. On the 28th of September 1940, I was posted to brigade headquarters as a motorcycle liaison officer and appointed brigade MT officer on the 9th of December 1940. Almost a year later, on the 24th of November 1941, I returned to my battalion, the 2nd 6th Queenborough Regiment, which at that time was in the area of Ipswich. I then volunteered for overseas service, thinking that it might be the Far East, and we embarked at Liverpool on the 14th of February 1942 on the Strathaird. We disembarked on the 2nd of April 1942, having transshipped at Durban from the Strathaird to the New Mauritania. I think it was the New Mauritania. I then went to the Middle East training depot and was sent up to the 8th DLI, who were then in the desert, on the 5th of May 1942, awarded the MC almost a month afterwards on the 5th of June, and wounded for the first time on November the 2nd 1942 at Alamein. That really takes us up to the end of 1942.
I think you also found details of your draft when you went forward to join the 8th Durhams at Gazala Lion.
Yes, I'll have to have that one, I think. Thank you.
Right.
Yes, I'm going to read this from the notes I made at the time. We were in the officers' mess of the infantry base depot early in 1942, when 8 officers were posted to a brigade of the Durham Light Infantry at Gazala, which had just suffered heavy casualties from an unsuccessful column action known as Roscoll, R-O-S-S-C-O-L, in front of the Gazala line. The 8 officers did not particularly like the idea of being posted to a regiment other than their own, and I must admit that I did not like it either. But we were to very soon find out that, in fact, we could not have been posted to a finer brigade, which consisted of the 3 Durham battalions. After our first day's journey, we stayed the night at Mirza Matru. We were surprised to find a group of officers who had left the infantry base depot the day before for the front, but their train had been machine gunned and the engine driver killed. They had been told they had been brought back to Mirza Matru and told that they would have to wait and move up with us the next day. I remember we swam in the Mirza Matru lagoon, which was very dirty indeed, with old transport ships and things moored there. And after dinner that evening, we sat down for a drink in the officers' mess. Somebody had done some paintings of very attractive blondes and brunettes in the Petty style. An old hand returning to the front said to me, "This is the last luxury you see going up, and the first you see if ever you get back." Whilst we were in the mess that evening, I heard someone say that we ought to watch out for milestone 105, which was where the German fighters regularly strafed the train of cattle trucks on its way up to Merzimetru. He reckoned that that was where the train was hit the day before. We got up very early the next morning, went down to the siding, and climbed into the metal cattle trucks. We had to shovel wood and straw out of the wagon before we could get in. It was Spike Galloway who was being posted to one of the other Durham battalions, who was the first to notice the freshly patched cannon shell holes in the sides of the metal wagon. One was just above my head, and the solder was still fresh. This, of course, was from the previous day when the train had been strafed. Our stop that night was Capuzzo, and on the way we watched very carefully for milestone 105. As it came nearer, we got a little jittery and got our things together in case we had to jump for it, apart from Spike, who didn't worry at all and simply went on brewing up another brew of tea. Nothing happened, in fact, and apart from some of the more rowdy members of a Scottish reinforcement draft who were moving up and who opened fire on an RASC convoy which was running level with the train until they were stopped, there were no incidents. We spent the night at Capuzzo, where I had my first experience of a minefield by walking into one without knowing it, looking for a latrine. I came back out of the minefield again, and I was quite unaware of the fact that I'd even been in it. I was informed when I got back that I had in fact been in the minefield. We left Capuzzo the next morning in a road convoy, and we saw our first evidence of fierce fighting along the road. We stopped that night somewhere in the rear corps area, which looked like the last place on God's earth, and afterwards proved to have been one of the first compared to what we found later on. Next day, the battalion transport collected us and took us up to the B echelon, which was some miles behind the forward positions in the Gazala line. We spent the night at the B echelon, and George Stray, Stray, the very much respected quartermaster of the battalion, said, "You either get the sack or the MC in this brigade." We arrived at the battalion next day, where I met the commanding officer. I also met my company commander, who showed me where I was to bed down. "That's your home," he said. "I found myself looking down at a slit trench about 7 foot long by 3 feet wide." And that really was my arrival at the battalion. We've already told the story of meeting the CO, I think, earlier on.
You mentioned Fort Capuzzo. What was it like? What did it look like when
you got there? I really can't remember. I mean, you say Fort Capuzzo, but I can't remember whether we were anywhere near the fort, which wasn't a very big fort anyway, because the officers' mess would have been in a tent, probably some little distance away. So I don't have any recollection of Fort Capuzzo. Lots of places in the desert sounded as though they ought to be most important, but they weren't, you know. Sometimes they're only a cairn of stones, or maybe a metal hut or something like that.
I think the last thing we were discussing was the characteristics of the Egyptian pattern mines.
Yes.
Which you said were rather shoddily made and unreliable.
They were. In fact, once they'd been put in, it was a good idea to leave them there and not try and dig them up and move them anywhere else, because they were very unpredictable and highly dangerous to handle. And they were called EP pattern. I assumed that they were made in the Delta, possibly by Egyptians. They certainly weren't as efficient or as well made as the German mines.
Were they anti-tank or were they anti-personnel?
No, they were anti-personnel mines, basically. When I say anti-personnel, they weren't anti-personnel to the extent that they
when they went off, they sent a lot of metal balls into the air. That was the S for sugar mine. But these were just straightforward anti-personnel mines, which the minefields were made up of around on the outskirts of the Gazala box.
They were made of metal?
Yes.
Did you come across Italian mines at all?
Yeah, they never worried us very... well, not so much there, but we did at Alamein. Really, the minefields at Gazala, there was a vast minefield which guarded the whole of the box, with gaps through the minefield which were the exits from the box. But we didn't actually get as far as any heavily defended German positions, defended in the same way, because they were much more mobile than us at that time. We were more or less dug in, and they were moving forward subsequently to get to Brook and to go on towards Alamein. So there wasn't a big defended localities that I can remember like we had got.
What was the... were these gaps marked? Were the minefields?
Oh, yes. Yes, the minefield gaps were all marked. I mean, Germans used to mark their minefields. You would see the sign Achtung Minen, M-I-N-E-N. And ours were marked in the same way.
How wide would the gaps be?
Wide enough for a lorry to go through, a Bren carrier, a 25-pounder gun and a portier, a 3-ton lorry. I suppose about twice the width of what big articulated lorries that you see today.
Did you also have wire or other obstacles in front of your positions?
Sorry?
Did you have wire or other obstacles to strengthen the positions you were in?
No, I don't think we did, actually. No, I think that would have given the thing away to a certain extent, and it wouldn't have really stopped anybody, because it could have been down at wire, which was in great big rolls, you know. If I remember rightly, we'd got the minefield. That was really what defended the box, and then you've got the infantry positions behind that, covering the minefield gaps. And don't forget, we also had our outposts, which were some miles in front of the Gazala line itself.
Now, you arrived on the 5th of May, went off to your platoon, having met your company commander. Was your platoon up to strength?
Yes, I think it was. I think they were all pretty well up to strength. They hadn't... the Ross column that had gone out was not from my company. It was another company of the battalion, which had quite a lot of casualties and people captured. So B Company, or I think it was C I went to, actually. But anyway, whichever company it was pretty well up to strength with men.
And was it also properly equipped, according to establishment standards?
Well, in so much as they'd got Bren guns and grenades. I mean, it was very well equipped compared to what we had had in England or earlier than that in the BEF. 2-inch mortars, Brens, there was a carrier platoon, there was a mortar platoon. Yes, in fact, I would say we were pretty well up to strength with the weapons we should have.
So effectively, it was a 5-platoon company?
No, not really, no, because the carrier platoon, it was 3 platoons of infantry in the infantry company. The carrier platoon was something entirely separate, and that had to cover the whole battalion. The mortars were also separate. They were nothing to do with any particular company. They were just switched around as and when they were required. So we were really a 3-platoon infantry company.
Now, you mentioned that when you first went off for a route march into the desert, there was a certain scepticism about your navigational abilities by the soldiers.
Yeah.
What sort of impression did you get of your NCOs, of your sergeant and corporals?
Well, I was very impressed with them. the regimental sergeant major was a very impressive chap. He was good at his job. The company sergeant majors seemed to be very good at their job, and they took a lot of the weight off of the platoon commanders and the company commander, and I found them very helpful to as a newly arrived officer, you know, especially as I'd come from a London regiment and was not even Durham, and I found the NCOs and the corporals and everybody all very keen. You know, there was no demoral, there was nothing. There was no demoralisation in that battalion at all.
Were they all Durham men in your platoon?
That I can't remember, because we'd had a draft. I think it was K.O. I think it was King's Own Shirt, or it could have been, no, Cosby, that's right. Cosby draft, which had joined the joined them before or during Ghazala. So there could have been a mixture of Durham and Cosbys. Most of the Cosbys, if I remember rightly, eventually became NCOs. They're a very good Cosby intake, which was welcomed into the battalion, and they did extremely well at a later stage.
Were your soldiers all Territorial Army men?
I would say that all the Durham ones were original TA from Durham. Durham's very strong on Territorial Army. I think it still is now, actually. And they came from places like Chesterley Street and Stanley. That's why one of the gaps was called Stanley Gap, that sort of thing. And I don't suppose a lot of them had even been out of their mining villages before they suddenly found themselves whisked out to the Middle East.
Did you have any regulars at all?
The CO was a regular, Jake Jackson. When I first arrived, Tim Beart was the CO of the 8th Battalion. He was a territorial. Chambers, the adjutant, was territorial. I don't think we had any regulars in the 8th Battalion at Ghazala. We didn't get a regular CO until Jake Jackson took over at Alamein.
What about the NCOs? Were any of them regular?
That's a difficult one. Some of them might have been, actually. Some of the sergeant majors might have been, the company sergeant major. But I've got a feeling that, you see, that battalion went to France in 1940 as a complete territorial unit. And it was made up to strength again when it came back to England. And I don't think it had many regular soldiers in it, other than possibly one or two of the CSMs. But I really can't say on that.
But anyway, it's evident from what you said that they didn't stand out as being regular as opposed to territorial.
No, not certainly not at Ghazala. No, they didn't anywhere, I don't think. You know, everybody seemed to get on remarkably well together.
When you were in the Ghazala position, was there much employment of formal discipline day to day? Was the battalion keen on such things as saluting and turnout and so forth when it was in the line?
well, I think, you see, between midday, say, and half past three in the afternoon, everybody went underground. I mean, nobody was moving about anywhere because of the heat. But yes, I mean, we weren't as sloppy as the Australians, put it like that, or as the New Zealanders, or the Maoris. I mean, but it was not the sort of thing where people swung a smart salute at each other if they happened to be, passing each other. Always, it didn't really happen like that. I mean, it's a little bit difficult when you've got men stripped to the waist, you know, and wearing just shorts and desert boots, maybe working on enlarging a slit trench or something. You didn't get a lot of people walking around dressed in fully dressed, if you can see what I mean. So you didn't see a great deal of that. But if you went to see the CO, you brushed yourself up, you know. And if you went in to see your company commander, you called him sir. But out in the section positions, it was most people wandered around stripped to the waist most of the time.
You called the company commander sir. What did he call you?
Mm-hmm. Well, I say you called him sir on official occasions, but we knew each other by our Christian names. So many would have called me Peter, and I would have called him Ian after a few days, probably, you know, I think. You didn't go up and sort of say, oh, well, Captain English, could I have a word with you? You say that in front of the troops and in front of the sergeant major. But when you were in the little officer's mess dugout or something, it would be Christian names. Bearing in mind that that was a TA battalion, and it would not have been quite like a regular battalion in that respect.
How did the NCOs speak to the men under their command? Were they on first name terms, or did they have their ranks used?
Well, the sergeant majors would always sort of say, you know, Corporal Pearson, let's have a little bit of action here or something, get on with this or get on with that. I think the NCOs and the men did tend to use the ranks more than the officers did, if I remember rightly. But they wouldn't have said Private Taylor, or he might have done, the sergeant major might have said Private Taylor over here or something like that, rather than call him Taylor, or rather than use his Christian name. Yes, I think you could say that they used the ranks more than the officers did. I mean, the colonel you would know as the colonel, and the adjutant you would refer to as the adj, you know, and the IO as the IO.
What was the sort of daily routine when you were in the defensive positions in the box at Gazala?
Well, bearing in mind that we got our outposts out in front of us, I think we stood to at dawn every morning. I mean, I think we always did that wherever we were, you know. You had to stand to. And after maybe an hour of a certain amount of shivering, and even with a greatcoat on early in the morning, and the hell of a lot of dew about, because the desert is very wet underneath, not very far down. It's quite wet, the sand. And you did get a lot of dew and dampness around in the early morning, before the sun came up, and sufficiently strong enough to sort of dry you out. So when you'd stood to, been a bit miserable wandering around, the greatcoat, the collar turned up and everything, then we'd probably have breakfast, you know, which would be soya sausages or something like that. We didn't do too badly with, you know, this is where if you've got a good quartermaster who could not only get the stuff but then get it through to the battalion, and you've got good company cooks, because the food was cooked by the company cooks, you could really eat quite well.
Where did you eat that? What, do you eat it in the fire trenches? Or?
Yeah, sit on the edge of it, probably. Once we'd stood down, you'd sit on the edge of your own slit trench, and if you were lucky, you might have a plate and a mug. If you weren't, you had to use the old billy can thing. Not billy cans, the mess tins.
How did you get the food? Did you send carriers to the company cookhouse to get it?
I would have thought that no. I think if I remember rightly, generally speaking, it was the company quartermaster sergeant who used to make sure that the food for a particular platoon came to the platoon headquarters, and then from the platoon headquarters it would go out to the sections.
So he'd come round in a vehicle?
In a 15 homeweight truck, probably, yes.
At
Gazala, anyway. And just unload the stuff off the back. Bearing in mind that half the water ration every day went to the company cookhouse, and he would bring it back in the form of tea.
So breakfast would take you, what, half an hour or something
like that? Something like that, yes.
And what would happen next?
Well, it rather depends. I mean, if anybody was going out on an early carrier patrol to do some commerce raiding, well, they would have been warned about it the night before, so they would be on their way out to the outpost. And from the outpost, they'd then have to carry out their patrolling mission, whatever it was. I suppose the rest of us didn't have a great deal to do. We might have done some PT or something like that. At Gazala, you weren't going to attract any attention if you did that. So I think there would have been PT.
Who would take it?
Take it? Probably one of the platoon sergeants or something like that. We didn't have a PT instructor attached to the battalion.
Did you do it with the men?
Yes, we would have done, yes.
Sort of PT would you do?
Arms and legs astride and bending at the waist and all that sort of thing. I think really just to keep people reasonably fit.
How long would that last if you did it?
20 minutes maybe, something like that. Not very long.
This would happen after breakfast?
Yes, yeah. I think so. I don't think we did that before breakfast, because we usually went straight from standing to a breakfast situation.
Okay, so then I'm trying to get a picture of a sort of routine day,
yes,
when you weren't on a patrol, when you were actually in defensive position.
Mm.
What happened after the PT, if you had that? How would the men be occupied, and how would you be occupied?
I'll be quite frank with you, I really can't remember. I mean, there were various things, I suppose, that had to be done before the heat came up at midday, such as maybe improving a slit trench or something, or doing a little bit of work, or maybe digging some of the dugouts a little bit deeper or something like that. And then probably there might be a company commander's... the company commander might decide to do a little bit of drill on the Bren gun or the 2-inch mortar or something like that. There would maybe be a bit of training, and if there was, that would have been done before lunch. Perhaps the CO might want to see company commanders over at battalion headquarters. He might want to see specific officers, maybe about a patrol the previous day or something like that. So there'd be a certain amount of activity in the morning, but it would come to a grinding halt as soon as the sun came up.
When you were training on the Bren, rifle and so on, would this simply be routine individual training?
Well, no, with the Bren gun, it was very important that it didn't get jammed up, which it very easily did if you weren't very careful. So it was a question, a lot of the training was how to take a Bren to pieces quickly and find the jam and get it together again, and also to stress the importance of not letting it get jammed up in the sand, which is very difficult, under pressure particularly. But it was very important, otherwise you couldn't keep the things going.
Did you have any difficulty with the rifle as a result of...
No, none at all, that I can remember. Rifles were quite okay.
What about the submachine gun?
Well, there was only one in each platoon, and I don't think that gave a great deal of trouble either, that I can remember. It was the Bren that we had to be careful about, because the Bren was such an important weapon. Although it only had a magazine with 30 rounds in, it had a much slower rate of fire than the German machine guns, so it didn't need to be replenished so quickly. But it was a very important gun, and a good gun too. Most people used to like using the Bren. You could also use the Bren from the hip, which was an advantage. You could walk with a Bren firing from the hip, and that was done quite often.
So you'd have your 2 or 3 hours of training, say, and then the sun would get up.
Yeah.
And what happened then in the heat of the day?
Well, you just go to sleep. You get in the bottom of your slit trench, pull the hessian over the top so the flies couldn't get at you, get a bit of shade from whatever you'd got, a bit of corrugated something or other outside, and then go to sleep, because there really was nothing else to do. I mean, you couldn't see anything. The heat haze was very, very intense indeed, and anybody walking towards you would look to be about 8 or 9 feet tall. The whole thing was just like a constant mirage, and this went on for the whole afternoon.
Until about what time?
Till about, I think, about 4 o'clock, something like that.
Did you eat anything at midday? Did you have lunch?
If we did, it would only have been a biscuit, a bit of hardtack or something like that. I think our main meal was in the evening, actually. But before we had that, it didn't happen at Gazala, but it did happen quite a lot at Alamein.